admit to Dr. Chopra that
everything seems stable.
Excellent, she says, reading through the notes before she passes the tablet back to him. In that case, I think we can probably discharge you tomorrow afternoon, Rose. Nurse Naomi here can help you with a bath now and put a fresh dressing on that incision. With a brief smile, she departs, and Dr. Kane shifts on his feet as though he's a metal fleck unable to resist her magnetic pull as she strides toward the door. His gaze bounces between me and the nurse, and then finally settles on me.
I'm not in tomorrow,
he says, and I don't know how to respond, the silence lingering a little longer than it should.
I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you. For everything. Truly. With a curt nod in reply, and a final beat of delay, he turns and strides away. Naomi and I watch the door, and I half expect him to come back in and say whatever seemed to be weighing on his mind those final moments before he left. But he doesn't reappear. Naomi turns my way with a brittle smile, shifting a lock of dark curly hair behind her ear. Let's get you up, she says, and raises the head of my mattress. There's a stretched silence as she helps me to sit up, a tense pause as though she's not ready to help me down from the bed. Everything okay? I ask. Her hand is trembling around mine. Yes. Are you sure? Her attention darts toward the door and back to me. Her eyes are so dark they're nearly black, but in them I can see every shade of fear and pain I've come to know in women who ask for my help. I know what she's about to say when she leans closer and whispers, I saw you at the circus. You're the tarot reader, aren't you? I nod. The sparrow. It's a reverential prayer. The sound of hope that I've come to know. A secret kinship bonded by suffering that transcends blood. I remember her face now, the woman who was approaching my tent with a rolled $20 bill in her hand. A spike of chemical impulse hits my veins. Everything sharpens. The details of the room, the sounds of staff who pass in the corridor, the smell of antiseptic and industrial cleaner, the spark in Naomi's eyes when I reach for the deck on my side table. I shuffle my cards. If we've got a minute, maybe I can give you a quick reading before the bath. I know the card I'm looking for by feel, by the fray at the edges, by the crease at one corner. I flip it over. Ace of Cups. It represents following your inner voice. What does it tell you? What do you want? The hope brightens in Naomi's eyes, and my heart responds with a quickened beat. To take flight. I smile. And though Naomi's spirit might be bruised, it's not broken. I can see it in the way she smiles back. I draw the next card. Maybe it's not what you'd expect. It's not death. It's not the Knight of Swords, not harbingers of chaos. I draw the star. Hope on the horizon. Because in killing, there can be living. There can be rebirth. Naomi shares her secrets in whispered notes. Stories of a man. One who demeans her. Belittles her, one who threatens her and harms her and controls her, one she can't break away from, not on her own. She asks me for help, and my heart swells until it aches, because I know this is something I can give, even if it takes a little time. My thumb caresses the tattoo at my wrist. I might have been abandoned here, left in a cage. Maybe my wings have been clipped, but I can still fly. Prairie Princess. Rose. There aren't many people around the Prairie Princess campground when the taxi drops me off on the gravel driveway, the driver waiting patiently as I wrangle my aluminum crutches out the car door and shimmy my way free of the vehicle. There's only a smattering of motorhomes. I guess it's not super popular to camp in a flat grass field outside Hartford, population 3,501. The taxi drives away and leaves me to the sound of children in the playground, all three of them pinning me with unnerving stares, the metronomic squeak of the ancient swings, a sad melody within the downtrodden campground. I pause long enough to give them a half-hearted wave. All three stop swinging in a synchronized sudden halt of motion. They don't wave back. Yikes. That's just fucking weird. One of them tilts her head, as though listening, even though there's no fucking way she heard me at this distance, and then all three resume their swinging at the exact same moment. I guess at least I know how I'll die. I swallow the sudden tightness choking up my throat and start to hobble my way across the unkempt gravel, my leg throbbing. My RV stands out among the others strewn across the clearing. Big old Dorothy might be closing in on 30 years old, but she's pretty as hell, with polished chrome bumpers and a custom paint job of a flock of sparrows over a sunset of pink and yellow and orange. I've put every spare penny into Dorothy's needs. She's my year-round home. But this is the first time I've ever walked up to my RV and wished I had something more permanent. Maybe the kind of place where it's not so easy for the rest of your home to just go and leave you behind. You're just being sore. You'll be back on the tour in no time, I whisper above the clink and rattle of my crutches. You'll be fine on your own. You're not afraid of the murder children, because you're a fierce, independent woman. And I believe that too. At least, I do until I stop at the door of my motorhome. Fuck. It's hot as Satan's ballsack out here beneath the unobstructed prairie sun, and all I want to do is get inside so I can lie down and, let's be real, probably ugly cry myself to sleep. Problem is, I don't know how to do that with crutches and a brace through a narrow door that's 2 feet off the ground and a set of narrow steps on the inside. I've never thought about buying folding or temporary stairs to get in. It wasn't something I ever needed. My shoulders sag as I press my weight into the padding of the crutches, my body already protesting this foreign way of moving. I'm blinking away exhausted tears when I hear a vehicle slowly roll to a stop behind me. I sweep a quick pass of my thumb beneath my lashes and then grip onto the handle of my crutches with renewed determination. I don't need people staring. I hobble closer and slide the key into the lock and turn it. And then a large hand reaches above me and pulls the door open. I startle, losing my balance as I turn, the sun blinding as I look toward the man standing behind me. He grasps my arm to keep me from falling.
I'm so sorry,
he says, his voice instantly familiar. He drops his hold on me just as quickly as it was given and moves back a step.
I didn't mean to startle you.
Mick Spicy. I squint at him, my gaze darting toward the classic Ford F-250 parked nearby, my motorcycle strapped upright in the bed. What are you doing here?
Scaring the shit out of you by the looks of things. I'm sorry about that.
He glances toward the open door and the narrow stairs that lead into my home and frowns. When he turns his attention back to me, the intensity of his narrowed eyes burrows beneath my skin to heat it.
I heard you were released this morning instead of the afternoon. So I thought I'd bring your bike back and check on you. How are you doing?
I could lie if I just had a bit more in me to do it. But something about this man makes me want to tell him more than I should. Maybe it's the way he watches me, his eyes fixed to mine, the door held open for me, his other hand lifted just a little, as though he's ready to catch me if I stumble. It's been a shitty few days, I say, my voice thinner than I hoped it would be. Dr. Kane's expression softens. His hold on the door relaxes a little, and it creaks on its hinges.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'll manage.
I have no doubt.
Really? Because you sound like you have many doubts. He looks toward the motorhome and shrugs.
I have doubts about the stairs.
When his attention returns to me, a smile tugs at one corner of his lips, his eyes a lighter shade of blue in the bright sun.
I don't have any about you. I mean, your ability to look after yourself, of course.
I bite down on a weary grin, though he doesn't see it. Not with the way his eyes dart to the shadowed interior of my motorhome, then the gravel beneath us, then back to his vehicle, as though he can't wait to get into it and drive away. You should probably have some doubts about me, Doc, I say, catching his gaze when it flicks back to me. But I'll still manage. Thanks for bringing my bike back. I'm afraid I can't help you unload it, though.
I can do that,
he says, and I nod my thanks, gripping onto my crutch handles as I refocus on the entrance of my motorhome. It's going to be even hotter in there than it is out here. Dorothy's been baking in the sun, but I'm desperate to peel off my leather jacket and strip down to my underwear and sleep until tomorrow. When I get to the step, I set my crutches against the side of the vehicle and grip the interior handle of the stairs. With the dock holding the door open, I hoist myself inside, but hiss a curse when I bump my splint against the ledge on my way up. "I'm good," I grit out. Dr. Kane scrutinizes me as I pivot on my good foot to face him, his forehead crinkling at my forced smile. I reach back out the door for my crutches, but instead of grabbing them, I knock them over like dominoes. "Well," I say as we both stare down at them where they mock me from the ground, both mostly hidden beneath the motorhome. "That wasn't great."
"Not a strong start, no."
"I'll manage."
"I can tell."
"You're not really helping." My deadpan joke seems to slap Dr. Kane out of his own thoughts and into action.
"I'm sorry,"
he says, his voice barely more than a whisper. He lets the door close gently, resting it against my elbow before he bends to collect my crutches. His faded gray t-shirt pulls tight across his back as he leans forward to pull them from beneath the motorhome. Hard planes of muscle bracket his spine, his shoulders broad and defined beneath the thin cotton. I swallow when he straightens to his full height and stands before me. I'm a hint taller than him where I stand on my little landing inside the motorhome, but he still seems to take up all the space in my field of vision. "Thank you," I say, a little breathless. I wrap a hand around one of the crutches and try to pull it toward me, but he doesn't relinquish it. "I'll manage."
"Yeah, I heard that, but you'd manage better at my house,"
he blurts out. His eyes widen as though the words have escaped his control. What?
"I mean, you should come to my house. This setup,"
he says, waving his free hand toward my home.
"It's not ideal. You can barely get into it."
"I just need some practice."
"You don't have air conditioning."
"I do, sort of. When Dorothy is moving and the windows are open. Also when she feels like it. Which is basically never." The doc gives me a suspicious frown. For a moment, I'm not sure if I said my thoughts out loud.
"What about a shower?"
"I'm sure they filled my water tank before they left," I say, scanning the grounds beyond his shoulder. "And when it runs out, there's a communal shower over there." Dr. Kane turns to follow my gaze to a small wooden cottage with a shower sign painted on the side, the building's green paint as faded as the unmowed prairie grass surrounding it.
"Looks totally safe."
"They only murder people in there on the weekends." Fionn faces me once more, his expression both wary and clinical.
"You need to look after that incision and come back in a week to get the stitches out and the cast put on. You can manage that."
I swallow down the assurances that would only be half-truths at best. With every moment that passes, I'm increasingly nervous about being the star in what is clearly a horror movie entitled Prairie Princess Campground, The Grisly Murder of Rose Evans. But I don't really want some guy I barely know to realize that. As much as McSpicy is hot as fuck and seems genuinely sweet, I'm used to looking after myself. And it's tough enough to face the fact that I can't get around the way I'm used to without a constant reminder that I need help.
"Rose."
A darkness settles into the hollows beneath Dr. Kane's eyes. He searches my face, hunting for something. Like he's weighing options and pathways set before him. The longer the silence stretches on, the more I long to fill it. When I shift to rest my swollen foot on the step behind me, he takes a sharp breath.
"Matthew Cranwell."
I try to keep my expression neutral, but we both know he caught me off guard. "Who?" I say, a beat later than I should have.
"Matt Cranwell,"
he repeats.
"Do you know him?"
I swallow. Shake my head. A shadow falls across his features, even in the bright light. Dr. Kane never averts his gaze, even when I try to break the connection and look away. He's still right there, taking up the space in my door, sucking up all the energy that seems to crackle between us in the hot summer air. The suspended moment seems to stretch long enough that I can imagine every thought and accusation that's probably swirling in his head. He leans closer, his voice a lethal whisper when he says,
"Did he do this to you?"
I want to back away, but I don't move. I want to shake my head, but I can't seem to make myself do that either. I'm like a fawn, unable to run when danger discovers it hidden in the grass.
"I suspect you're not the only person he's hurt,"
Dr. Kane says. His shirt stretches over his biceps, the muscles more tense than they need to be for the simple action of running his hand through his hair. Strands fall across his brow, his forehead creased in a frown.
"Do you want to tell me what really happened that night?"
Each breath I take is so shallow, it might not even exist. My heart riots in my chest. I still can't shake my head, even though it could be the difference between me and the back of a police car. "Be tough. Be tough, be tough, be tough. You drive a fucking motorcycle in a metal cage in front of an audience of 200 people in a goddamn circus. The fucking Globe of Death, for fuck's sakes. Don't cry, Rose Evans. Don't you fucking cry." I totally fucking cry. A single tear slips past my lashes, sliding down my burning cheek. The crease softens between his brows as the doctor watches me sweep it away with a frustrated flick of my fingers. "I'd better go. Thank you, Doc," I say, trying to pull the door closed behind me, but he doesn't let it go.
"Rose, he's not the kind of person you want to fuck with."
His expression darkens, and it feels as though there's no escaping his warning.
"He was a Lincoln County deputy before he got himself suspended a few years back. Something about an arrest that got out of hand. From what I heard, it was the last straw in a string of bad behavior on the job. Now he spends most of his time between two places. His farm outside Elmsdale, and the Ferguson's grain mill, which is literally next door,"
he says, gesturing toward the back of my motorhome. I look in the direction he's pointing, but I see nothing. Nothing but wheat fields beyond the fence that encompasses the campground, with no structures and no landmarks visible. When I turn back to the doc with a question in my crinkled nose and furrowed brow, he rolls his eyes.
"Okay, fine. Next door is a few miles that way, but it's still next door, technically."
I can't say I love the idea of Matt being in my neighborhood, even if that neighborhood is a bunch of plants and a view for miles, an unobstructed perspective that makes it hard for him to sneak up on me. But I'm guessing he's a crafty motherfucker, even if he is down an eye. My stomach flips uncomfortably. I stare blankly at the horizon, my mind trapped on the memory as I replay the image of driving the cocktail sticks into his face.
"I can help you."
The softness in Dr. Kane's voice pulls me away from the imagery, a soothing caress, so unlike the violence of that night. When I turn to him, something about the curves and angles of his face seems pleading.
"It's safer in Hartford. I hardly ever see him there, only at the clinic once or twice a year. Elmsdale is closer for him."
The doctor's eyes don't leave mine as he pulls something from his pocket and holds it between us. Matt's license.
"Come and stay with me. I have a guest room, a hot shower, functional air conditioning, edible food. I even know a thing or two about looking after injuries."
I blink at him, processing his words as he patiently waits for me to catch up. "I'm out of work," I finally say, dropping my gaze to the splint that encases my leg. "I can't pay you."
"I'm not asking you to."
Dr. Kane passes me the license. With a tentative hand, I grasp the edge, but I don't pull it away. "You're not going to serial kill me in my sleep, are you?" I ask, narrowing my eyes. I've only asked him that to make him laugh. For any other man I barely know, it would be a legitimate question. But there's something about Dr. Kane that puts me at ease. Maybe it's the way he held my hand in the ambulance. Maybe it's the way he holds this damning piece of evidence between us, one that could so easily be used to put me in jail. But I think it's just an essence, like a vibration in the air, something I can't touch or taste. Something I just know. I'm safe with him. A grin slowly ignites in his full lips.
"You're not going to serial kill me in my sleep, are you?"
I shake my head.
"Good. Then why don't you pack up some of your essentials and we get the fuck out of here. This place gives me Children of the Corn vibes,
he says as he looks toward the seemingly feral group of kids on the swings. Same, honestly. Except that's wheat, not corn.
It's still crops, and creepy kids, that's enough for me.
With an unsure smile, I pull the license free of his hand and slide it into the interior pocket of my jacket. He unloads my motorcycle as I water my plants and throw a few changes of clothes into a backpack. When I get back to the door, he takes the bag from me and slings it over a shoulder. Before I can struggle my way down from the ledge, Dr. Kane slides a strong arm around my waist and lifts me out of the RV, igniting an electric charge that skitters through my chest and dances along my ribs. I feel as though I'm floating in the bracket of his muscular grasp, like it takes no effort on his part to take my weight. When he sets me down, it's done carefully, slowly. He offers me his arm for balance and waits until I'm steady on my foot before he passes me my crutches. And even when we leave, he walks with me, matching my slow pace when he could easily stride ahead. I don't remember the last time a man walked me to the passenger side of a vehicle, or opened the door for me, or got my belongings situated before carefully helping me inside. I don't remember anyone buckling me in. Not ever. But he does all those things, chatting the whole time, telling me about the truck and his house and the town. He flashes me a fleeting smile before he closes the door, and I can't recall ever feeling the way I feel now about such a simple gesture. Dr. Kane slips into the driver's seat and keys the engine. He shifts it into gear, but keeps his foot on the brake as he turns to look at me.
Anything I should know before we do this?
That electric charge I just felt. It seems to burn in my guts. I shake my head again.
Okay, good,
he says, and then we roll away from my motorhome and the Prairie Princess Campground. I should stop him. Place my hand on the sun-kissed, corded muscle of his forearm as he reaches forward to turn up the volume on the radio. Tell him what really happened with Matt. I should shatter this moment. I should do it now, before it shatters me. The truth rises to the surface, but it doesn't quite break through.
Left unsaid. Fionn. What the fuck am I doing? I've asked myself that at least 30 times on the drive home from the campground. I've tried not to let it show that this thought is consuming me. I've kept up conversation, trying to distract myself from this mantra that repeats itself on a loop beneath my inner monologue. But now that I've lifted Rose out of the passenger seat and sat her down on the walkway to my home, it blares through my mind like an air raid siren. What the fuck am I doing? Helping. That's what I'm doing. She asked for help, and something about her desperate request has embedded into me, a thorn that's lodged deep in my mind. The strange thing is, I can't remember any patient having asked me before, not like that. Symptoms, histories, medications. I've heard family ancestries passed down in the building blocks that make each one of us unique. I've heard fear and gratitude, but I've never heard that simple plea for help. Not until Rose. And she needs it. Rose struggles up the steep stairs to my door on her crutches, the locomotion still unfamiliar to her. She hisses a string of curses. I want to simply pick her up and deposit her on the landing, but I hover behind her instead, waiting for her to work out the best way to maneuver on her own. When she gets to the narrow porch, she turns toward me and offers a weary but triumphant smile. I try not to be spellbound by it, but I think I fail.
Well,
she says, snagging my attention away from her full lips and back to her eyes where it belongs.
That kind of sucked. Hope I don't have to get anywhere quickly.
You did well.
Would have been easier if you just picked me up.
I grip a hand over the back of my neck, trying to recall if I actually said my thoughts out loud. Probably.
Maybe you should make me an adult-sized baby Bjorn and just carry me around, strapped to your chest.
She barrels on, a teasing glimmer bright in her mahogany eyes.
Can you imagine? Trips to the grocery store would be fucking hilarious. If you have a sewing machine, I can totally make that happen.
What the fuck am I doing? I think again, but this time the question has taken on a whole new meaning. Rose is standing on my porch, grinning at me like a little demon. Sure, she asked me for help, but I don't really know this woman. What if she's a complete weirdo? Or worse, dangerous, unhinged? I know so many dangerous, unhinged people that maybe my barometer for that shit is broken. She certainly didn't seem like it the first few times we met, with those big brown eyes rimmed with thick dark lashes and her angelic face framed with chocolate fringe, the waves untamable as they cascaded over her shoulders. But there's a mischievous streak in her that I think is maybe just a little fissure that leads to an endless well of chaos. Her expression softens, and I wonder for the second time if I've spilled my thoughts into the world. I swear she's climbed into my head when she says,
"Don't look so mortified, Doc. I just get extra weird when I'm nervous, and you're standing there being all doctory and shit. I'm only joking."
I knew that.
Probably having second thoughts about letting me in your house now, though, right?
Maybe. No.
That was totally a maybe. It's cool. I'll be 100% fine with the corn children. Trust me.
She says, flashing me a smile as she firms her grip on the crutches and swings closer to the stairs. Hold up. My palm is wrapped around her wrist before I can even string together the arguments about whether or not I should touch her so casually. Rose's eyes linger on the point of contact. I should let go, especially with the way she stares down at my hand as though we're soldered together and she can't work out how or when it happened. I'm not having second thoughts. Just, please, come in. Though I uncurl my fingers from her wrist, the loss of that touch resonates in my skin. I open the door, and for a moment she hesitates. Then, with a faint smile that evaporates in a halo of nerves, she turns and passes over the threshold.
"It's a nice house,"
Rose says as she swings her way into my living room, the click of the crutches filling the space with a metallic melody. She casts me a brief smile over her shoulder. As though drawn by a magnetic force, she maneuvers closer to the coffee table until she bends to pick up the crocheted coaster resting on the surface. It was the very first thing I ever crocheted. The pattern is imperfect. Some holes are larger than others. I'm not sure what she must be thinking as she inspects the cream-colored yarn. She holds onto it as she pans her gaze across the overstuffed couches and chairs, then toward the simple kitchen that still clings to a 1950s vibe despite the new paint and countertops, and then the dining table where only one placemat rests on the surface. Jesus fucking Christ. Seeing my home through someone else's eyes is humbling. Literally one placemat. And a single crocheted coaster. What the fuck must she be thinking? Probably the same thing my dickhead older brothers think about my life here in Hartford, Nebraska. And it's the first time I really acknowledge that they might be onto something. Lachlan was right. I'm knee-deep in my peak Hallmark, sad man, cinder, whatever era.
It's really nice,
Rose says again as she sets the coaster down. You think so?
Yeah.
When she turns to face me, her smile seems genuine. Maybe a little melancholy. She puts on a brighter smile when she says,
I really do. Feels like a proper grown-up home. Something befitting of Dr. McSpicy Kane.
I snort a laugh and set her bag down next to the couch as I head past her to the kitchen. Just call me Fionn. Rose replicates the pronunciation. When I look over, she's watching me, her dark eyes fixed to mine as though searching for something.
I'm sorry if I'm upending your life, cramping your style or whatnot.
You're not. Part of me wants to admit to what she must already be thinking, that despite her polite words, there's nothing much to upend. Now that she suddenly appeared, I realize how minimal my life has become. How monochrome. It's just work, gym, more gym, and more work. A monthly appearance tending to the wounded fighters at the Blood Brothers barn. My only real socialization has been with Sandra and her club of crocheters every week, and that only started for me a few months ago. I guess that's what I wanted when I moved here. Maybe not the crocheting, but the solitude. And yet, this is the first time I've wondered if I don't want the result I've successfully achieved. I clear my throat as though it will rid me of these questions I don't feel ready to explore. Want something to eat? Rose's stomach responds before she has a chance to, releasing an audible growl.
That would be great. Thank you.
I bring out my blender from the cupboard and set it on the counter, then rummage in the freezer for frozen greens. Rose taps her way to the table, setting the crutches against its edge. I look up when she drags a chair back and lets herself down with a heavy sigh. She lifts her injured leg onto the chair next to her and closes her eyes, tilting her head back to rub her neck, the shimmering sliver of flesh on her chest exposed by the low V-neck t-shirt she's wearing. I've definitely been avoiding even the remote potential for romantic encounters way too long if that tiny slice of flesh threatens to upend all my attention. I look away, though it's harder to do than it should be. I start cutting oranges just to keep my focus where it belongs.
How long have you lived here?
She asks, and there's a shuffling sound that draws my gaze back to her. She has a deck of cards in her hands, their edges bent and softened with use. Just over 4 years now. I watch as she nods and sets the deck on the table. I was in Boston before that.
Is that the accent I hear?
No, I was born in Ireland. She nods again and flips a card over, leaning closer to examine its details.
You left when you were young. 13, right?
My hand stops midway to delivering oranges to the blender. My head tilts. How'd you know that? Rose looks at me and grins, her eyes devious and sparkling.
Magic.
I'm just about to pepper her with questions when she shrugs and drops her gaze to the card.
Or maybe it was just a lucky guess. Figured you were old enough to keep the accent, young enough for it to soften. 13 seemed about right.
She flips a second card and hums a low note. Tarot, I ask. And she nods without looking up. Is this what you do at the circus?
Yeah, in part. But mostly, I'm the sparrow in the cage.
She says theatrically, framing her last words with jazz hands. She glances up just long enough to catch my confusion.
I ride a motorcycle in the globe of death.
I open my mouth to ask her 1,000 questions, but she turns the conversation back on me before I have the chance.
So, you ended up in Nebraska in an attempt to avoid romantic relationships?
I snort a laugh, picking up a carrot to start peeling it. Let me guess. You came up with that one due to the bachelor vibes of the house. Was it the doily that gave me away?
No, but I do have questions about that.
I'm getting the impression you have many questions. I plop the carrot into the blender and watch as Rose examines 1/3 card and shakes her head. How did you know about that? Rose pins me with a stare that slides right into me. One that burrows in. Drills beneath layers that suddenly seem too thin to hide behind. I don't just feel looked at or assessed. I feel seen. And after a moment that seems like it's pulled too tight by an invisible hand, her expression smooths, as though she's found what she's looking for.
Magic,
she says. And with a wisp of a sad smile, she takes the cards and shuffles them back into the deck.
How's that working out for you? Being here, I mean, getting away from Boston?
I don't know. I slowly start to peel another carrot. I can feel her eyes, the weight of her watchful gaze. She says nothing, just waits to see which way I'll take her question. And part of me wants to elaborate on the honest answer I just gave her. But I don't. What about you? How's the circus working out for you? Rose breathes a laugh, but I can sense the disappointment in it.
Not so well now, I guess. They all left.
When I look up, she does a little shimmy on her chair, wiggling her fingers before she pulls what seems to be a white crystal charm in the shape of a bird from her jacket pocket. She makes a slicing motion through the air in front of her, and then places the object on her deck. Though I want to ask her about it, I don't. Already feeling thrown off course by her presence, without broaching the realm of crystals and divination. I clear my throat, trying to regain my sense of balance when I ask, "How old were you when you joined Silveria?" Rose's smile fades, turning brittle at the edges.
15.
"Pretty young," I say, and she nods once. "Why?"
"Had nowhere else to go."
Rose shrugs as she pockets the crystal and shuffles her cards.
"When Silveria Circus came to town, I took half the money I'd saved and spent all day there. Next day, I took the other half. Third and final day, I went straight to Jose and begged him for a job. He didn't say yes, but he didn't say no. When they pulled up stakes to leave, I hitched a lift with one of the crew."
Her expression is brighter when she looks up at me, blowing a strand of hair from her eyes.
"I worked and he fed me. I proved I was tough and he paid me."
"So what, you just left home?"
"No, I just left."
I want to ask her what she means, but the light seems momentarily lost from her eyes. I watch as she flips over a card and hums a thoughtful note. "Do you enjoy it?" I finally ask, unsure if I should be scraping away at her past when the present is already enough of a mess to dissect.
"Normally it's great. I get to travel. I love the troupe. I'm always seeing new places, meeting new people. But I guess it's not so great when something like this happens,"
she says as she gestures to her leg. "Does stuff like that happen often?"
"No, not to me."
"What about stuff like Matt Cranwell?" Everything in the room goes still. I feel like I'd be able to sense our heartbeats in the air if I reached out with my palm. Rose says nothing. Doesn't even blink. I can't read much from her expression, but part of me already wants to rewind time and reel those words back into my mouth. I don't know this woman. Whatever happened is none of my business, whether she's staying here or not. Prying into her life is unfair. I've offered my home, without anything in return. Not even secrets. I'm about to apologize when Rose says,
"Not exactly. No."
My gaze lingers on her for a long moment and then I give her a nod before I focus my attention back to the blender and the smoothie. When it's ready, I grab two glasses from the cupboard and fill them with the thick liquid, taking them to the table with a pair of metal straws. I pull the chair back from the end with the single placemat, Rose's eyes on me through every motion. "I'm sorry, it's none of my business," I say as I pass her the smoothie, though she doesn't move or even break her gaze from mine.
"I'm staying in your house. You have a right to know the kind of person under your roof."
"Listen," I say, curling my hand around my glass to stop myself from touching her, the sudden impulse taking me by surprise. "I've had some suspicions about Cranwell. I don't see him often, but when I do, there's something about him. An instinct I have about the kind of man he is, you know? I realize that's not a very scientific thing for a doctor to say. Oh, I shouldn't be telling you any of this, really." I shake my head and lean back, studying Rose's face. Those dark eyes, those full lips that press tight as though fighting to hold on to whatever thoughts and worries are curling through her mind. "I just know it. He's a dangerous person. And if he did this to you..."
"You were right. When you asked at my RV, I'm the one who stabbed him in the eyeball,"
Rose blurts out. Her eyes are enormous. So big I almost laugh. I don't think I've ever met anyone who could express so much with just her eyes. And now, the rich shades of chocolate seem liquid with fear. "I kind of thought so," I reply, and impossibly her eyes get even bigger as pink infuses her cheeks. The essence of pina colada was a bit of a clue, but the license really sealed the deal. Rose swallows, nods, but she doesn't crack a smile, despite the joke and the grin that still lingers on my lips.
"I should go. I don't want to bring trouble to your doorstep or make you uncomfortable in your own home."
When Rose clamors to lift her braced leg from the chair next to her, I grab her wrist. "Stay, please." Even her wrist is tense beneath my grip. I can feel the strain of her tendons, the hammer of her pulse against my fingertips. Every cell in Rose is ready to run, or more accurately, hobble her way out of my house. And I should be letting her. If I were a better man, I will be driving her to the police station, or at the very least, back to the creepy campground. But I have absolutely no desire to do either of those things. Though still eyeing me with wariness, Rose settles at least a little in her chair. I don't let go of her when I say, "Did Matt Cranwell injure you, Rose?" She doesn't say the words, only nods, barely a perceptible admission, and that faint, simple movement is enough to set my blood aflame. The only thing anchoring me to this room and keeping me from fulfilling a sudden dark urge to strip the skin from his face is her. Her warm skin beneath my palm, her scent lingering in the air, a faint note of cinnamon sugar and chocolate and a hint of spice.
He didn't see my face. I was wearing a full-face motorcycle helmet and the visor was down,
she whispers. She looks at her leg for a long moment before she returns her attention to me.
It was a baseball bat, not a motorcycle accident.
He hit you with a fucking baseball bat? Rose nods. Why didn't you call the police?
I didn't want to make things even harder for his wife, Lucy,
she says with a shrug as she looks down, as though she can't bear to maintain the thread of contact between us.
If she hasn't called the police already, there's a reason. Maybe she's not ready, or she's afraid of the consequences.
Rose meets my eyes once more, and this time they're fierce, lit with dark determination.
He's hitting his wife, Doc, and I don't regret what I did. If I could do it again, I'd make sure he never made it to the hospital in the first place.
She says it with such absolute certainty that I don't doubt every word is true. My blood turns viscous, lava in my veins. I've seen Lucy Cranwell only once at my clinic, when she brought one of their kids in for a chest infection 6 months ago. She was quiet, shy, polite. It wouldn't have been a memorable encounter aside from a single comment she made as she pulled out her phone to send a text. It stuck in my brain like a barb, but at the time, I didn't know why, so I only turned it over long enough in my thoughts to dismiss it.
I just have to text Matthew,
she'd said, darting an apologetic glance to me.
He always likes to know where I am.
I let go of Rose's wrist to drag my hand down my face. My focus slides to the door of my house and sticks there. It's begging me to walk through it, to get in my truck and drive, to not stop until I'm at Cranwell's house, and after that. I shut off those thoughts before I can fall into madness. They're vines that will twist and turn and trap me in a dangerous life I can't escape. I've seen it happen. It's in my brothers, Lachlan and Rowan. I've felt those same urges constrict around me, but I've learned to put those desires into a box where they will wither. Forgotten, starved of light.
He might not have seen me,
Rose says, pulling me back to the present.
But how many women show up randomly in a small town with a busted up leg? It won't take him long to find me, if he wants to. I really do appreciate your offer to bring me here, but I probably shouldn't have accepted. I really don't want you to be in harm's way. You've done so much for me already. We haven't even talked about the break-in or the mess I made at your clinic.
Rose's expression is sheepish, but there's something mischievous about it too, as though she might enjoy leaving a little chaos in her wake. To be honest, I was relieved it wasn't the raccoon again. Do you know how hard it is to get a codeine-addicted raccoon out of a ventilation system? Fucking hard. Rose's expression brightens.
I kind of wouldn't mind watching Dr. McSpicy rolling up his sleeves and getting into fisticuffs with a crazed trash panda.
Fisticuffs? I snort. Well, chances are you will. It happens more often than it should. The light that seems to linger in Rose's eyes starts to dim. When she glances toward the door, I lay my hand on hers despite the voice in my head that tells me not to. Listen, Cranwell lives outside the next town over. So what? It's 15 minutes away and you've already told her this. He hardly comes here. It's not like you keep tabs on him, dumbass. Doesn't have many friends. No fucking idea how many friends he has. Could be friends with the whole fucking county for all I know. I take a deep breath that fills every crevice in my lungs. Please just stay. I promise I'll bring you to the clinic so you can watch me get my ass handed to me the next time the trash panda infiltrates the fortress. I'll be worried about you with the corn children if you go back. Rose says nothing, just keeps her eyes locked on mine as she leans forward and wraps her lips around the straw. For a brief moment, fantasies about those plush lips flash through my mind, but they're cut short when she takes her first sip of the smoothie, and her expression transforms to one of thinly veiled disgust.
And I'll maybe stay away from the green smoothies,
I say with a grin as she slides the glass in my direction. I could tease her for the abashed look she gives me, but instead I take the glass to the kitchen and return to offer her my hand. Come on, I'll show you your room. She looks at my palm as though trying to work out a mystery, and it takes her a long moment to slide her hand onto mine, watching it as she does, as though this small action is a revelation. When she stands, I help take her weight until she's balanced and ready for her crutches, and then she follows me down the hallway. I figured this one would be better, I say as we stop outside the second of two guest rooms and I push the door open. The other one has an ensuite, but it's narrow. This way, you can have the main bathroom to yourself, and this tub is a little lower, so it'll be easier for you to manage. I'll be right across the hall if you need anything. Is that okay? Rose swings her way into the bedroom. Her gaze pans across the details, everything bland and in monochrome. Everything except the new floral bedspread in shades of coral pink and cornflower blue, two deep yellow pillows leaning against the wrought iron headboard. Her gaze lingers on the bed. Maybe she sees the fold line still pressed into the fabric from when I bought it just this morning. Maybe she realizes I bought it just for her, in the hopes she might agree to stay. Rose turns her smile toward me. The warmth of it hits me like a dart to the chest.
Yeah,
she finally says.
I think that's okay.
Shadows. Fionn.
What are you doing with this information, Dr. Kane?
I rest an elbow on my desk at the clinic and rub my forehead. Lachlan is not a man to be fucked with, especially not when you're his youngest brother.
It's not that big of a deal. Cranwell is a piece of shit, and he's been up to no good. I want to know how big of a piece of shit he really is. Christ Jesus,
he groans on the other end of the line.
This isn't about a woman, is it?
No.
Why not? Maybe it should be,
he continues, his voice gruff yet teasing.
Get you out of your Hallmark sad man cinder whatever era. Whether it has anything to do with a woman or not, you wouldn't be happy either way, you broody asshat. Why bother meddling in the first place?
A dark smile of triumph tugs at my lips when Lachlan grunts on the other end of the line.
How's your love life going, since you're so invested in mine? Still fucking your way through Boston with abandon? Or have you finally run out of women who will put up with your ornery attitude? Shut up, you feckin' gobshite, he hisses. I have not been fucking my way through Boston, I'll have you know. Ever since that Halloween party where you spent the night drinking away your feckin' sorrows, only to throw them up again in my feckin' sink the next morning, I've decided to remove myself from the dating scene in the hopes I don't wind up as much of a dumbass as you.
He tisks, though I can tell he's enjoying every minute of forcing me to relive my fall from grace that weekend.
Couldn't even make it the extra 2 feet to hurl in the toilet like a normal adult man. You had to clog my feckin' sink.
He loves reminding me of that night, I think in the hopes that I'll become so annoyed by his teasing that I'll move back home just to prove to him I can take it in person. But when the city is home to your almost fiancé and the shattered remains of the life you thought you wanted, one-upping your overbearing brother simply to stop him from taking the piss out of you just isn't sufficient motivation.
You know, Lachlan, every time you tell me that story, you remind me why I think Nebraska might be growing on me.
Lachlan grumbles something in Irish and I grin, a smile that fades as my focus returns to the true purpose of my call. Now that you've gotten that out of your system, I need to know about Matthew Cranwell.
Lachlan sighs, and I hear typing in the background. My brother might claim to hate his side gig as a contract killer, but he'd still be the first to admit that his access to information and resources does come in handy from time to time.
Fine. I had Connor pull some information together like you asked. There wasn't much, so don't get too excited, yeah?
I nod, though he can't see me, and grab my pen and paper. Lachlan rattles off Cranwell's birth date and location, his social security number, the date of his marriage to Lucy, and the names of his three kids. There are bank details, debts, his suspension from the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office for his role in an aggravated assault 6 years ago, a bar fight that got out of hand. Since then, he's had a surprisingly minimal police record for someone as unpleasant as he seems to be, just a drunken disorderly citation from last year. I've already gone through his medical history, but Lachlan mentions the high points anyway, including the eye surgery. There's nothing that unearths the true depths of Matthew Cranwell's darkness. No grand reveal. No damning mark. But my instinct tells me the darkness is much deeper than what we can see.
That's all I've got,
Lachlan says, and I imagine him tapping his silver rings along the edge of the desk in the Leviathan office, a place he's told me about but never shown me, always wanting to keep me and Rowan at arm's length from his batshit crazy boss, Leander.
Anything else you want to know?
Temptation bubbles to the surface. I could ask about Rose. I know so little about her. How does one become a motorcycle circus performer anyway? What series of choices would lead her there? Where has she been? What has she seen and done? Her name is right there on my tongue, but I don't say it. Not only because I want to unravel her mysteries for myself, but because I can't bear the thought of putting her at risk. My brother would never knowingly hurt her. He might be an assassin, but at least he has a conscience. But Leander Mays? Not so much. He would fuck anyone up if it provided him enough gain to justify the effort, whether it's power or connections or money. I can't stomach the thought of Rose being anywhere on Leviathan's radar.
No, thank you. This has been helpful, I finally say. Not too helpful, I hope. Just helpful enough.
Lachlan hums a thoughtful note into the phone, and then we say our goodbyes. I stare down at my notes for a long while, reading and rereading the information until I'm confident I've memorized it before I take it to the shredder and destroy it. And then I grab my jacket and leave. It takes just over 15 minutes to get to Elmsdale. A few more to get to his farm. I drive past it, just a hint slower than the speed limit, and park by the poplar trees that border the northwest corner of the field that stretches from the front of his house where my truck will be hidden by the dense foliage. I open my door and take a deep breath of the impending storm. The first drops of rain pelt my jacket as I walk the shoulder of the deserted highway toward Matt Cranwell's driveway, my eyes never leaving the house. There's no light on inside the home to fight the encroaching darkness of the massive thunderstorm that rolls toward us. At first, it seems deserted. And then I hear the whine of a grinder coming from the barn. I stop and just stand there, watching the place. It looks like any other farm. A simple house. Toys in the yard. Outbuildings and equipment. I'm not sure what I'm even doing here. Staring at someone's house as the sporadic drops of rain gradually become a downpour. Someone could see me, even with the storm covering the land with an early film of darkness. What the fuck am I doing? There's a flash of lightning, illuminating something lying at the edge of the driveway. It's peeking from between the first stalks of corn at the edge of the field. An aluminum baseball bat. In another flash of light, I imagine every moment of Rose's injury. The way Matt Cranwell must have struck her. The force of his blow. The rage and malice painted across his face. Her agonized scream. I hear and see it all. I feel it. Just like I'm standing right there, watching it unfold. Help.
Before I truly realize what I'm doing, I'm halfway up the drive and there's no turning back. My gaze slices to that bat, the dented metal beaded with rain. My hands curl into fists. It takes every last thread of my restraint not to pick it up as I pass. When I'm a few feet from the barn, the grinder stops, leaving only the quiet crackle of an old radio behind. I halt, but the thought of backtracking down the driveway doesn't cross my mind. I just wait in the rain, listening as something heavy collides with metal. A handful of words passes through the narrow wedge of the open door, the tone gritty, the sentence disjointed. Cranwell is talking to himself, but beyond the occasional swear, I can't make out much of what he's saying. A moment later, a ratchet ticks as it tightens a bolt, and I take the opportunity to move closer to the light and peer inside. Cranwell faces away from me. I haven't met him many times, but I remember enough to recognize him, particularly with the strap of an eye patch biting into shining flesh at the back of his head. There's a buzz of an incoming call on the phone lying on the metal frame next to him. I watch as he wipes a hand on his overalls and answers on speaker.
"What do you want?" he bites out. Not a question, but a demand.
"I need to run to the pharmacy before it closes. Macy's cough."
"I thought I told you to make dinner."
There's a pause. I hear a child cough in the background of silence. I'd be willing to bet my medical license that she is bronchitis.
"Yes, I'm sorry."
"Then go make it."
Matt presses the screen to end the call and refocuses on the engine.
"You will be, you dumb bitch."
My blood surges, a wildfire in my veins. Heartbeats roar in my ears. I close my eyes, lost in a moment of memory. An image of a man much like Cranwell, filled with hate and loathing. My father. His face is so clear in my memory despite the years that have passed. There was rage in it the night he attacked us for the last time. I can vividly recall the split flesh of Rowan's lip and Lachlan's scream, the tip of his finger missing, a pulsing spurt of crimson blood left in its place. I can picture every detail of my father's back as he turned it on me, ready to deliver another blow to whichever one of my brothers was willing to face him next. And I still remember the weight of the knife I had hidden in my hand.
"Son of a bitch!"
Matt hisses. I dart back into the shadows. But it's the banged up utility terrain vehicle that he's talking to. It isn't me. He bends over the engine and cranks the ratchet.
"Dumb old piece of shit."
That's right. You are a dumb old piece of shit. I slide back into the light and watch as Cranwell reaches deeper into the network of metal, his arm buried to the shoulder. I pull the sleeve of my jacket over my hand and push the door open to step inside the barn. There's a table to my left where the grinder sits discarded on a stainless steel worktop, the surface dull with scratches and spatters of grease. Tools are strewn next to it. A rusty hammer, a set of screwdrivers, a roll of steel wire, and a hacksaw. My fingers wrap around the matte blue handle of a wrench and I lift it from the table. Lightning flashes beyond the windows, the glass caked with a film of dust. Thunder rattles the walls a heartbeat later, so loud it feels like the world is breaking apart. Cranwell's back is still to me, his hand buried in the belly of the engine. Thunder and rain. The radio drones a soothing melody. We are blanketed in sound. Our own cocoon. One hit is all it would take. No one would hear him scream. My hand tightens around the wrench as I take a step closer. I see Rose's face. Her fear. He did this to her. Just like he hurts his wife, maybe his kids too. And he'll keep doing it, just like my own father did. It never gets better. It just gets worse. The only thing that stopped my father was death. The same will be true of Matt Cranwell. I could do it. I could deliver the blow that ends his miserable life. Something creaks in the shadows on the other side of the room and I stop, frozen in time.
"Papa, I fed the chickens."
I duck behind the end of the table, pressing my body against the wall, the wrench still gripped in my hand. There's a grunt from Cranwell, a clank of tools.
Good. Get out of the rain. You can help me with this piece of shit.
There are some shuffled footsteps, the sound of a raincoat being discarded somewhere. I peer around the corner of my hiding place and watch as Cranwell hands his son a flashlight and tells him to climb up on the frame to hold the light above the engine. The boy does as he's told, and the two of them peer down into the heart of the vehicle, only a few words passing between them as Cranwell twists the ratchet in the engine. What the fuck am I doing? Hands shaking, I turn back into the shadows and press my eyes closed. This question seems inescapable. More multifaceted than I ever realized it could be. I'm a doctor, for fuck's sakes. I chose my profession specifically so that I could right the wrong I can never take back. I am a good man, not a dangerous one. So what the fuck am I doing even thinking about killing a man I barely know? What the hell is wrong with me? With one last glance around the corner, I carefully set the wrench down on the worktop and slink back to the open door. I leave the barn, jog down the driveway. I don't glance at the bat as I go and keep my eyes instead on the road ahead. When I walk through the door of my house a short while later, I shed my damp jacket and soaked boots before heading to the kitchen. My fingers still tremble as I drop an ice cube into a glass and fill it halfway with bourbon. I knock back the amber liquid. The burn slides down my throat. It does nothing to destroy the image of Matt Cranwell in the barn, his back hunched as he worked on the engine, the wrench beckoning me with urges I once thought I'd overcome. My hand still feels empty without it, the rage in my flesh not cooled by the chilled glass in my palm. I pour myself another and take the bottle with me as I head toward my room.
You motherfucking baby, get your shit together,
Rose's voice says as I pass the bathroom. My steps falter and I pause outside the door.
Not so fucking tough after all, are you? Well, you'd better suck it up if you want to be a...
Rose? I knock on the door and the volley of vitriol stops immediately. Are you all right in there? There's a long pause.
Yeah?
You sure?
No.
Can I come in? Another pause. I hear water lapping at the edges of the tub and then the rustling of fabric.
Okay.
When I open the door, Rose is sitting on the edge of the tub in a robe, her crutches discarded on the floor, her brace resting on the counter next to the sink. Water glistens on her chest and her good leg, but her injured one is dry except for the edges of the wound dressing where it's pulled back at one corner. What's going on? I ask as I set my glass and the bottle down next to her brace. Rose's cheeks flush with a crimson glow and she looks toward the floor. My heart cracks a little when she meets my gaze, but only briefly, like she can't bear to hold it.
You told me to take the bandage off today.